Well, as you know, we have been talking about how we got the Bible. Tonight we're going to talk about the Sinaitic manuscript. We began talking about manuscripts. First, we talked about the making of ancient books and the important things there to help us to understand about the writing materials and why that's important to help us to understand why we don't have some of those manuscripts anymore. In the second lesson, we talked about the birth of the Bible, the importance of the codex, how they came from scrolls to a codex, which have been much, much more convenient than a scroll. A scroll, of course, was rolled on two ends of a stick. And if you have the whole New Testament on there, even part of a book on there, and you're at the beginning of it, and you want to read something from the end of Luke, you've got to scroll, scroll, roll to get to the end. Whereas, of course, with the book, you just open up, flip a few pages, and you're there. And so that was an important understanding and an important thing that was developed. Manuscripts. We began to talk about manuscripts of the Bible last week, the unsealed manuscripts and some of the important unsealed manuscripts, and then we continue with that tonight. The unsealed manuscripts are of the oldest manuscripts. They are the capital letter manuscripts. We'll talk about the minuscules or the cursives some soon in another lesson. And they were dated later. They started that style later in about the 9th or 10th century. So immediately when they see a cursive manuscript, they know it is of a later date. Those are also important witnesses. Sometimes we think that those later manuscripts are not important. They are important. They're all important to add to the witness as we look at the Greek text to determine what the original was. And so these Bible scholars look at all of those things. And so the three unsealed manuscripts, the capital letter manuscripts, the oldest manuscripts, were the Vaticanus and the Alexandrinus, and the one we're talking about tonight, I've always pronounced it Sinaiticus, but I've heard others pronounce it different ways. Sinaiticus, Sinai, of course, is the beginning of that word. It's where it was found at the foot of Mount Sinai at St. Catherine's Monastery, and so it gets its name from that. And so Sinai, Sinaiticus, I'm not sure the pronunciation. I'll probably go back and forth, but you'll know what I'm talking about. There is St. Catherine's Monastery. It is at the foot of what is traditionally known as Mount Sinai. It is in the region where we believe Mount Sinai was. From a very ancient times, the locals believed that this was the mountain of God. Whether it is the mountain where Moses actually received the Ten Commandments, we don't know. At a very early point, we know sometimes with biblical archaeology, some of the early people just said, okay, this is where it was, without knowing for sure, and then it became the traditional place, and so people ever since then have said, well, this is the place. We don't know that this is the place exactly. There are several mountains like this. Peaks, they're not mountains like the Rocky Mountains, they're not that high, but they are mountainous peaks there in the Sinai Peninsula. And so very early, I'll have the date in a minute, I forget, around 450 AD, at a very early point, they built this monastery there. You see the walls of the monastery to protect them from the Bedouins and from tribes that some of the monks were being attacked by. And it has existed and been in various forms. It's been updated through the years in different ways. But it's basically at the same location as it has been for 1,500 years. And so it is now the property of Egypt. If you want to pay to go there, you can do that. They have tours that go to Mount Sinai and to St. Catherine's. I would love to go there. That's just the Bedouin in me, I guess. But I'd love to go there just because of the history, not because I think that's where Moses was, I don't know, but because of the history of this story. This story is fascinating as far as biblical manuscripts are concerned. 1550, there's the date, built in 1550 by the Emperor Justinian. It was built as a military fortress as well as a place for the monks, safety for the monks who were in that area. that started collecting there and living there because of their belief that this was the proximity of this was the mountain where Moses had received the Ten Commandments. It is one of the oldest continuous, it may be the oldest continuous monasteries in the world. It was named for a woman, a Christian named Catherine. There was a legend, whether it was true or just a legend, we don't know. But the legend was that she refused the advances of the emperor Maximinian, who was the emperor of the western part. Back then, in those days of the Roman Empire, they had two emperors often, one in the east and one in the west. And he was the emperor of the western part of the empire in those dates. If you remember your history, those dates are pretty close to Constantine. He was put out of power, in fact. Constantine, that we know from church history, that legalized Christianity. Constantine, and he served at the same time. Constantine kind of overthrew him and became the emperor. And so that's that period of time when, by this legend, she was refused his advances, this man's advances, and was put to death. The story, of course, here is about Constantine von Tischendorf. He has been referred to as the Indiana Jones of biblical research. Now, that's an old movie now. Casey probably doesn't even remember. You remember, okay. Indiana Jones and the Indiana Jones movies, I think they came out in the 80s, in the early 80s. But Indiana Jones was looking for, I even forget the movie. It was some kind of religious relic that the Nazis were also looking for because they, pardon me?
The Ark of the Covenant.
Ark of the Covenant. But Tischendorf, of course, was not looking for the Ark of the Covenant or a religious relic. He was looking for manuscripts. Some have even speculated, I saw some articles online that speculated that the Indiana Jones character was taken from Tischendorf. Don't know if that's true or not. They had some similarities. They both were looking for something very valuable. They both were looking for it in the areas of the Middle East. They both were individuals that were very bold and unafraid. I don't think Tischendorf ever had to deal with a pit of snakes. I don't know anything about that. But even I read an article that said that he was the Indiana Jones of biblical research. So I don't know if that's an overstatement or not. He was a German scholar in the early to middle 1800s. Those were the years of his birth and his death. He specialized in biblical criticism. It was his desire to put together the very best New Testament manuscripts that he could, even to that date. What we have to remember is that all through the Middle Ages, the Roman Catholic Church had, do you remember the we haven't talked about translations in the Vulgate yet, but the Vulgate was the translation that the Roman Catholic Church used all through the Middle Ages. And their monks did not study Greek and Hebrew. They studied Latin. They studied the Vulgate because that was the language of the church. And so Jerome's Vulgate, and we'll talk more about that in a later lesson when we talk about translations. But Jerome's Vulgate became the official translation, the official Bible of the Roman Catholic Church. And all through the Middle Ages, there was no interest on the part of the church. And there were no universities like there are today, and there was no, in fact, remember when we came out of the Middle Ages into the Renaissance, if you remember your world history, the Renaissance was the period when there was a renaissance of learning, because during the Middle Ages, there was just no learning. It was the church, and then there was the people that just lived out on the land, and it was a very poor society in Europe. And so there was not this desire for knowledge. There was not this study of the humanities. There was not this study of the Greek. And so in the 16th century and 17th century and 18th century, as they were coming out of the Middle Ages and through the Renaissance, there began again to be an interest in studying the classical languages of Hebrew and Greek. Those those studies had just disappeared. And so people very early, like Erasmus and Tyndale, we'll talk about some of those names later even more, they began to study these languages for the first time in many, many, many generations and learn them for the first time in many, many generations. So there were people who are now were trying to reconstruct the Greek text, because that's where the Bible had first come in, was the Greek and the Hebrew in the Old Testament. They were trying to revive these languages and learn these languages. And so during this period, people like Tischendorf were looking for manuscripts. His was a worldwide, you know, this story tonight, as what happened at St. Catherine's at Mount Sinai, was just one stop of many stops he made. He scoured the old libraries. He scoured the old monasteries. He traveled widely looking for manuscripts that might increase their knowledge about the biblical text, especially the Greek text. Let me say something about New Testament criticism. There, that term is used, New Testament criticism. And what is meant by New Testament criticism is the desire to put together the best Greek text that we have. As we have talked about, the original text, the original autographs, as we refer to them, the ones that Peter and Paul and James and John wrote, those no longer exist. And because there were so many copies and there were some mistakes along the way, the goal of the critic, and when we use the term textual criticism, we're not talking about people that are enemies of the Bible, that are critical of the Bible. The word criticism is not being used in that way. The term here, biblical criticism, is the desire to identify the textual variants that are there, to look at the manuscripts, to look at the different versions, and the goal is the identification of errors and try to reconstruct as best we can the original text. And so it's a positive use of the word criticism. Criticism in the sense of being critical of and looking carefully at and trying to reconstruct the biblical text, the Greek text. And so that's the idea of criticism. Now, the word criticism is also sometimes used. There's two forms of biblical criticism today. One is the criticism of the text to reconstruct the text. But the other is what they call a modern liberal form criticism, which is not a good thing. And I won't go into that right now. But that's a different kind of level. They talk about higher criticism and lower criticism. This, and those are kind of technical terms that are used in the scholarly world. But lower criticism is this criticism of just recovering the text. Higher criticism is the philosophical, where did we get the Bible? Where did it come from? We know God could not have given it. The modern liberal scholars say, well, we know it was not really written by Moses, so how did it really come into, and they have all these theories in there. That's higher criticism, and it's gobbledygook, and it's not worthy of our attention, except to just kind of counter it. But lower criticism, what we call lower criticism, biblical criticism at this level, is the reconstruction of the text. Okay, so Tischendorf was concerned about liberal theology. Even in his day, he was concerned about liberal theology. And he wanted to increase our knowledge of the Greek text and reconstruct it, and to show that it was very ancient indeed. There were already theories in his day that it wasn't so ancient. There were theories that John did not write by 80 or 90 AD, but that John's letter wasn't written until 200. And he was concerned with the kind of things he was hearing in some of the universities already in the 1800s, the early 1800s. And he was trying to counter it. And so he wanted to study the Vatican manuscript, but basically, he was denied. If you remember from the book, it mentions that a time or two, back under the Vatican section last week, that he was allowed just a few hours with the Vatican manuscript. Well, if you know anything, anybody that's scholarly, being allowed 3 hours to look at a manuscript is not very much. And so it was very disappointing to him. He couldn't take notes. So the Catholic Church was withholding it basically from the world for a long time. Now they've let it be known. They've taken, you know, pictures of it to where it can be seen and studied by scholars everywhere. But back then they weren't, they didn't play well with their neighbors. They didn't want to share the information and show it. Some think that the Vatican was fearful. Again, remember what we said about the Vulgate. What does the word Vulgate look like?
Vulgar.
It looks like the word vulgar, and that's where it came from. What's the word vulgar? What's the back meaning of the word vulgar? We think of it as bad words, vulgar. Originally it meant common. Common. The reason for the Vulgate was because it was in the Latin, the common language of the people at the time. And so it was called the Vulgate because it was the vulgar vernacular of the people, the common language of the people, the common Latin of the people, which was a good thing. But the Vulgate was in Latin, and that was the official language of the church. And some people think that the church didn't want Tischendorf at the time or other scholars to see the original manuscripts, because by studying the manuscripts, they would see how badly the Vulgate had been translated, that there were many mistakes in the Vulgate, and they didn't want anyone to see that there were mistakes in the Vulgate. That was their translation. They claimed that was the God-given translation. That was the translation of the church that the popes had put their stamp of approval on, and if you study this document, you're going to find out all the mistakes in it. And so some think that was the motivation. We don't know for sure. They never said. Von Tischendorf really made his name as a scholar even before he discovered this other document that we're talking about. Tischendorf made his name, his reputation as a scholar, when he translated the Codex Ephraemi Receptus, or whatever it is. You can decide. It was a fifth century unsealed. This is what it looks like. It looks like a mess, doesn't it? It's a mess. The reason it looks like a mess, what does it look like to you? It looks like two different documents on one, doesn't it? It looks like a lighter document, and then someone wrote a darker document over the top, doesn't it? You see that? That's exactly what it was. What happened was, because parchment was so valuable, they would sometimes wash it, scrape it and wash it, and then use it for another document instead of throwing it away. And so that's what they had done. Someone had rubbed out. This is a good word for your next dinner party. You can just kind of throw this out. People think you're really scholarly. It's a palimpsest. The Greek word palimpsest means to rub again or to rub out. And so they would take an old document and they would scrub it and rub it and get as much ink off of it as they could and then write over the top of it. Well, in this case, this was an old 15th century manuscript that they had tried to rub out. And right over the top of it, this Ephraemi, the word Ephraemi there, is because what was written on top of it were sermons from I forget the years, 10, 1,000, 1,100, sometime during that period of time, there was this preacher, and that was his name, and someone was copying his sermons over the top of this old manuscript. And so that's where it got its name. But it was a very old manuscript, but it was very, very hard to read, and no one had been able to read it. But Tischendorf did. It took him months and months and months. They said he had very good eyesight, and he was very patient. He was a very patient scholar, and he pored over this manuscript for months. He even added some chemicals and things to try to improve being able to read it. And he translated it. And so this was a very ancient manuscript going back again to about 450. Then he set out on a tour to visit as many monasteries and old libraries as he could. After he kind of made his name as a scholar, then he found people who are willing to support him. You know, you can't just go traveling. Then or now, you can't just go traveling when you don't have any money. And so as he kind of made his reputation as a scholar, he got sponsors to enable him to do traveling and to look for more manuscripts. And so he traveled throughout Holland and England and Switzerland and Italy, and gathering and looking for manuscripts. And he was very successful. On that trip, this particular trip, after he had gone through Europe, he turned his attention to the East. In particular, he wanted to visit St. Catherine's Monastery at Mount Sinai. So let's read page 45 and 46. Who would like to read for us the bottom of page 45 and the top of 46? Go ahead, Donna. Yes, that paragraph that begins, it was at the foot of Mount Sinai.
It was at the foot of Mount Sinai in the convent of St. Catherine that I discovered the pearl of all my researches. In visiting the library of the monastery in the month of May 1844, I perceived in the middle of the great hall a large and wide basket full of old parchments. And the librarian, who was a man of information, told me that two heaps of papers like these, moldered by time, hope I said that right,
yep,
had already been committed to the flames. What was my surprise to find amid this heap of papers a considerable number of sheets of a copy of the Old Testament in Greek, which seemed to me to be one of the most ancient that I had ever seen. The authorities of the convent allowed me to possess myself of a third of the parchments, or about 43 sheets, all the more readily as they were destined for the fire, but I could not get them to yield up possession of the remainder. The two lively satisfaction
yes.
I had displayed had aroused their suspicions as to the value of this manuscript. I transcribed a page of the text of Isaiah and Jeremiah and enjoined on the monks to take religious care of all such remains which might fall in their way.
Okay. And so at this first visit, this was his first visit to St. Catherine's, 1845, he came upon these documents that were in, that were like scrolls, I believe. But anyway, they were kind of in just, in, no, that probably was a codex. But anyway, they were in, apparently in cans, had been set, and they were being used to start fires with. And he later testified in his books that he never saw them being used to start a fire. He doesn't know that they were really used for that or whether that was just the story they were telling him. He was never very clear or very sure about it. But anyway, the monks there didn't read Greek and Hebrew or anything like that. They didn't realize what they had. And like we said, even to this time, Latin was the language of the church, and they didn't even realize what they had. And so he found these sheets, and he was able to leave with them. He got their permission for him to take these. There were others. He knew there were others still there, but they didn't give him those. And he mentions there that his too lively satisfaction, I think he's saying that he was so excited about it that he caused them to suddenly, they realized how valuable they were then, or that this scholar's excited about these, so that, no, we're not giving you any more. They don't want to, it's like someone shows interest in something at a garage sale, and you're saying, well, I'm not sure that's 10 bucks anymore. Maybe that's 100 bucks, you know. But they let him have the 43 sheets, and he took them back to his own home in Leipzig, Germany. He published the 43 sheets. At that time, he didn't tell anyone where he found them because he was wanting to return. He didn't want someone else to beat to his game. And so he didn't tell where he got them. But on that trip, he already had found about 50 other manuscripts, none of that age. But you see, he was scouring everywhere, coming up with all the manuscripts that he could and being fairly successful about it. He went back a second time, a very disappointing trip when he didn't get anything really. And finally on his third trip, he convinced the king, the Tsar of Russia, to finance a third trip. And that was the trip when he made the big discovery in 1859. So you see, that's some 14 years after the first time he was there. So let's read that page. Where is that? That's on page 47. 47. Casey, would you like to read that long paragraph there in the middle of the page? Yes, please. Okay, let me stop you there just for a second. So, just to catch up, he came the third time, and at the first part of his trip, he was still unsuccessful. Didn't really find anything of significance. Very discouraged. He had come from Cairo, and he had to, now this is a long journey. I forget what they said, 4, 5, 6 days by dromedary between Cairo and the Sinai Peninsula. I mean, this was not the 21st century. This was not flying in an airplane like you would today and taking a bus with a bunch of tourists for 3 or 4 hours out to Mount Sinai. That was not then. And so he really was like an Indiana Jones. I mean, he was riding donkeys and dromedaries and things like that to get to where he wanted to go. Okay, go ahead, Casey.
Sunset, he begged me to take some refreshment with him in his cell. Scarcely had he entered the room when, resuming our former subject of conversation, he said, "And I too have read a Septuagint, i.e., a copy of the Greek translation made by the 70s.
Okay, I'll stop her again. So, they had been talking earlier about the Septuagint and Tischendorf had told him that he had read a copy of the Septuagint. The Septuagint was the Old Testament Greek, okay? The Old Testament in Greek, and which was written by 70 scholars. That's the reference there to the 70, okay? Go ahead.
In so saying, he took down from the corner of the room a bulky kind of volume wrapped up in a red cloth and laid it before me. I unrolled the cover and discovered, to my great surprise, not only those very fragments which 15 years before I had taken out of the basket, but also other parts of the Old Testament, the New Testament complete, and in addition, the Epistle of Barnabas and a part of the Shepherd of Hermas. Full of joy, which this time I had the self-command to conceal from the steward and the rest of the community, I asked, as if in a careless way, for permission to take the manuscript into my sleeping chamber to look over it more at leisure. There by myself, I could give way to the transport of joy which I felt. I knew that I had held in my hand the most precious biblical treasure in existence, a document whose age and importance exceeded that of all manuscripts which I had ever examined during 20 years' study of the subject. I cannot now, I confess, recall all the emotions which I felt in that exciting moment, which was such a diamond in my possession.
Okay, and so he's talking about the Septuagint to this individual, and he says, "Oh, I've read a Septuagint. Let me show you the copy of the Septuagint that I've read." I don't think the guy knew what he had, or the importance of what he had. But it was not only the Septuagint, but it was the Greek New Testament, of a very ancient manuscript. That's why I say these guys didn't realize what they had. But anyway, so he makes this discovery. That night he translated the Epistle of Barnabas. He didn't sleep all night. He just translated the Epistle of Barnabas. Why did he do that? We wonder, well, why of all the books? And Barnabas is not even in the Bible. What? Well, at the time, it was considered by some people to be canonical, a part of the Bible. And also, he had always heard of it, and scholars of his time had heard of Barnabas. He had seen other references to the epistle of Barnabas, but all copies had been lost. And so he said, this is a chance for me at least to write down a copy of the epistle of Barnabas that we've been hearing about for all these years. So he wanted to take a copy of that home, and so that night he copied it. After negotiations, he negotiated with them, and he was allowed to take the manuscript to Cairo. First, they gave him permission to take it to Cairo for a few months, and he took it there, and he made copies of the whole New Testament. Ron?
Yeah, I like what the son-in-law said about it. First thing he did when he went to his room, we got down on his knees and prayed and thanked God.
Yes. He realized what he had. I think he was a sincere, you know, when you read, I haven't read all the history about Tischendorf. Some people think that he did the monastery dirty, that he didn't keep his promises later about returning the manuscript. There were accusations about him later. I have no idea what is true and what isn't true. But I think the general history of it indicates he was not. Another thing, difference between him and Indiana Jones, he was not looking to make it rich off of some relic. He was truly, sincerely interested, and I know Indiana Jones was a fictitious character, but he was truly interested in these manuscripts, in getting the best Bible that they could. And so eventually, through the negotiations, a long story, most of which I don't have any clue about, he was allowed to take the manuscripts to Cairo. Later, he was allowed to take them all the way to Russia and make them a gift to the Russian Tsar. It was in the possession, this manuscript was in the possession from the 1800s, middle 1800s, up until 1933. What had happened in Russia in the early 1900s? Anybody remember? What happened in Russia in after World War II in 1917, 1919, somewhere there was the Bolshevik Revolution. Before then was the Tsar of Russia had this document in his library. But once the Tsar was taken down from power and the Russian communists were now in power, they didn't care anything about this. They needed the cash more than they needed some old relic. And so they sold it to England for £100,000, which was at the time about $500,000 in value. It would be almost $8 million today. But I bet you couldn't buy it for $8 million today. There's no way you could buy it. It's not for sale in the first place. It'd probably take 100 times. It'd probably take $8 billion if someone was going to buy it today. It's that valuable. Well, today it is in the British Library. As we said, it was sold to the British. It was put in the British Museum. As I told you about 50 years ago, the British people built a separate building for the archives, and so it became known as the British Library. So that's where it is today. Same organization, different building. There's the division between the leaves, 393 leaves total. It's on fine vellum. It's about 15 inches square. The pages are 4 columns per page. It's dated to 350. Think about that, 350 AD, a very early date. The handwriting would indicate there were 4 different scribes that took part in it, Tischendorf discovered. And it is the oldest complete manuscript that we have of the New Testament. And so it's very, very important in our research. Yes, ma'am.
What is vellum? I don't know what that word means.
Vellum is calf skins. So at a very early time, well, they used to write on papyri. This was one of the lessons you missed when we talked about books. But they wrote on papyri, but papyri was very flimsy and fell apart very easily. And later they discovered using animal skins. And so they learned a way to get, the younger the animals, the thinner the skins and the better they made. And so vellum was either calves or sheep, very thin skins. They had a thin skin. Okay. But that's what vellum is, yes. Other manuscripts. This gets into the next chapter. I said I might get a little bit into the next chapter, and so this is the next chapter in our book. Remember, we have 5,300 Greek manuscripts. Here is the Codex Ephraim that we talked about. It is housed in Paris in the National Library of France. It contains materials from all the New Testament books except 2 Thessalonians and 2 John are missing for some reason. This is the one that we said was a palimpsest, that it was written over the top of another document. Or really the codex is underneath the document, sermons over the top. The second text was written over the original was sermons by a theologian. I mentioned that. It dates to about 450 AD, and so it's very important and very valuable. The Codex Beza is named for a Protestant reformer, Theodore Beza. Beza was a close comrade and associate of John Calvin. So you know the name Calvin much bit more than you know Beza. But Beza was one of his right-hand men. In fact, it is said that Beza took over the congregation after Calvin's death there in Switzerland. I can't remember. But Beza was a scholar. Beza was a right-hand man of Calvin. He had this codex. He had this manuscript, and it's named for him, but he didn't trust it. He was comparing other manuscripts with it. It had the four Gospels, and it had Acts, but he was not very high on this one. Its size is 8x10x8. It had 146 vellum leaves. It was, the Gospels are in a different order than what we have them. We're called the Western Order. They put the two apostles first and then Luke and Mark. The reason that Beza didn't think it was the best manuscript is because it had a number of really weird readings in it, additions that are nowhere else, that we found nowhere else. So somehow, somewhere, some weird readings got into this manuscript. Most of it's pretty good, but there's some weird readings in it. And so, for example, in Luke chapter 23, verse 53, it says, he placed over the tomb a stone which 20 men could scarcely roll. Well, that's not in any other manuscript anywhere, that 20 men could scarcely roll. So somehow that was added by someone. It has another weird reading. In Acts 12, when Peter and the angel came out of the prison, in that story, it says they descended the seven steps. Well, that's not in any other manuscripts either. And then in Acts 19, verse 9, in Paul's discussions at the school of Tyrannus, it says that he was there from the 5th to the 10th hour every day. Well, that's in no other manuscript either. So it's just some weird readings. Does it change anything doctrinally? No. But it's just, you kind of look at those and you wonder. For instance, this is a phrase that's at the end of Acts. No one else has this. At the end of the book of Acts, in Acts 28, after the Jews had come and Paul had talked to them and all of that when he came to Rome, it says, this is Jesus, the Son of God, through whom the whole world will be judged. Well, that's true. The whole world will be judged by Jesus. There's nothing wrong there, except it's just not in any other manuscript. So Beza saw these unusual things and says, I just don't know how much we can trust this. And so anyway, that's that. But it is a manuscript. It is very early, and it is used often, you know, as comparison. They take all the information. That's the thing about anybody, a doctor, a lawyer, anyone else. If you're going to be honest with whatever skill you have in this world, you look at all the information. You may discard some of it and think, well, this is not as good, this is not as reliable. But you look at all the information honestly and objectively and seek the best conclusions you can. Okay, well, that's it for tonight. It's 12 minutes till. We'll go ahead and stop. Any questions before we sing a couple songs? Oh, someone still. Did someone read this?
Yeah.
Okay, who wants to read it? Ron, you're going to read it for me? Are you sure? And you guys get ready to correct him because... as he tries to read this ancient manuscript, we don't want any mistakes. Yeah, see?
See, he'd be a good scribe.
He would be a good scribe. He would, because he's a very exacting student. He's a close and careful student. And so it looks like, you know, I just threw that in, and he has an example, of course, in the book as well, because sometimes when we say, well, the unsealed manuscripts had no periods or commas, no spaces between the words, people say, well, how could they possibly read it? Well, you can see you can read it. And there's only so many possibilities when you start looking at some of those words. There's only so many ways that you could possibly read it. And very seldomly, in a little paragraph like that, there's there even a question, because it's just pretty straightforward. Okay, any other questions or thoughts? Chuck.
I was just going to say, as you go further, I like the Bible in verses, but sometimes that's a hindrance because they've got chapters where there shouldn't be chapter divisions.
Yes. No, that's exactly right, that there are a number of places in the chapter and verse divisions that we've been handed just by tradition or whoever did it, and I'm glad it was done, like you said, for finding things, but they made some mistakes with that. Our son gave me a Bible a couple years ago I really like. It's an ESV, and it still has the chapter divisions, but it has no verse divisions. For the purpose of trying just to read it without the verse divisions, just read it straight through. And that's kind of a fun way of reading it, to try to get out of your mind the verse divisions and just read it. Just what does it say without, you know, being distracted by these verse numbers. And so I told him the only improvement would be just take out the chapters too. But it would be hard to find stuff, I guess, too. Okay, thank you, everyone. We'll plow ahead next week with the next. I got about half or part of that next chapter done. Finished up that chapter. So I did like a chapter and a half really tonight. And I'll do another chapter and a half next week. So read ahead another chapter.